CliffCentral.com.
I'm not getting the hype. I'm just not getting the Ed Sheeran hype.
It's okay. I mean, it doesn't have to be for everyone. It's fine.
Yeah, look, I get it. It's easy listening. You can sit by a campfire. You can be drunk and singing along to this. He's obviously just captured the market, right?
Yeah, sure. He's the flavor of the month. You know, it happens.
It does happen. So we've got Stuart Taylor's here with us. Morning, Stuart.
Morning. How are you?
Good.
I'm great. As you can see, besotted by Ed Sheeran. Did you know that currently this guy's got 14 out of the top 20 songs on the charts are his?
Yeah. Look, I have a six-year-old who is obsessed with Shape of You.
Oh,
but yes. Only because he can read the word you and of, and he's just learned that s-h makes sh. So it's like a thing for him. It's not real. It's more phonics than the actual.
Yeah.
Well, there we go.
The actual song, but it does mean I have to listen to Shape of You on repeat on the drive to school.
Oh dear.
I'm trying to get to the science of Ed Sheeran this week because he's doing very well musically and action-wise. Like he said, he's betting more people than Mick Hucknall.
This is impossible. I think everyone in their life, if you've ever lived in Cape Town, you possibly walked in to a flat and Mick Hucknall was there with some chicks. This is a true story. Like the stories of Mick Hucknall in Cape Town. Like, just, oh, yeah. Oh, did you also? Yeah, no. Mick will take your daughter down, okay. Your friend's girlfriends down.
Wow,
Mick Hucknall's
wow.
Crazy.
That's tremendous power
so,
there.
Exactly. So I don't know. Ed Sheeran is a much younger man, but I mean, Mick had many years.
Yeah.
So true. I don't think it's...
I think it was more on strike rate. In take a cricketing term, you know, he's like the choir of...
Fair enough. Maybe Mick Hucknall now... And Ed Sheeran now, maybe currently they're on the same strike rate.
I still reckon Mick Hucknall, what he's doing now is he's going to countries that haven't quite heard of him just yet. He's probably going to like Latvia or like Moldova or something. Like those countries that always get things 10 years later.
Yes.
And Mick's probably just, you know, bit of Old Spice on the chops and he's just he's still betting women. Singing roller coaster songs and stuff.
Yeah.
But speaking of music, now Stuart, obviously we got you in because we want to talk about your new show, but there's a couple of stories we couldn't get to. Because the thing with Justice is he's so good.
He is very good. He is very good. He just makes you want to book a plane ticket to another country. He just makes you want to check visa immigration laws. And I'm the most optimistic South African you will ever meet. Like I love everything about this country and I believe in every part of this country. And then you listen to Justice, you're like,
And then you realize.
I heard New Zealand is lovely this time of the year.
But the thing is, like, Justice is exactly the same. He believes in this country. He loves everything.
He's got such passion. And you know what? That's what we need more of. I don't think we need less of Justices. We need absolutely more of Justice.
And also just asking the right questions. Because then when we become informed, we know what to do about certain things.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Too many things just get swept under the rug.
So I wanted to kind of keep on the music. And now the big story happened yesterday around Snoop Dogg. I don't know if you heard about this. So,
I did not. Tell me what happened.
Latest music video, he is sort of mock assassinating a clown president. Which is very obviously what it is. It's Donald Trump in a clown mask.
Right.
So in this music video, of course I have to describe it to you because this is the audio means. So he's got a gun and he's literally to the head of this guy who is very much Donald Trump. He's got the wig, he's got the orange, he's got in a red tie. And then he pulls the trigger and this little sign comes out saying bang.
Okay.
So there's a huge hoo-ha around this right now.
Oh, are people outraged?
Yeah, of course.
Well, Donald was outraged. I saw Donald's tweet. Now I know what the tweet is about.
Oh, yes. Did Donald actually respond?
Donald tweets about everything. If I tweeted Donald right now and said people are talking about you on Cliff Central, he will respond with an actual tweet.
He has no self-control.
In true presidential behavior, Donald took to Twitter, because that's what you do when you're the president of the United States. He said, can you imagine the outcry would be if Snoop Dogg, failing career and all, had aimed and fired the gun at President Obama? Jail time! ! But have you noticed how every time he wants to go something, he'll state the person,
and then he'll find comparisons to Obama.
Yeah,
but first he'll assassinate your character.
Exactly.
Like he'll say something about you.
It's almost like it's the Donald sandwich, right? So the bread is basically who it is and Obama, but the middle is how you are nothing.
Yes,
it's like how you are shit. It's like New York Times, which is going out of business, by the way. Keep writing bad stories. You can't just say New York Times is writing bad stories. stories.
He's got to give you like a little inside track.
And I love
how... Let me give you my inside info.
I love how he, you know, he gives that little extra bit of information as if it's 100% pure fact.
Yes, because that is exactly where, like, that is the factless part.
Yes, yes,
it is
exactly.
It is the baloney in that sandwich.
Seriously, I didn't even think about this prior to this, okay? The very tweet below, I'm looking at the screen here. Does anyone believe that a reporter, who no one ever heard of, went to my mailbox and found my tax returns?
Oh, man.
This guy is so good.
We found his hook. Wow.
We've cracked the code. The baloney. Speaking about food as well, this is something that we need to keep bringing up. Okay. I know that I sometimes go on these big health things and it's important that we have good information like this. You know, the whole gluten-free thing? Well,
yes.
More and more stuff's coming out that gluten-free diets have been linked to type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, but as I said yesterday, you would be surprised at how few people actually know what gluten is when you ask them the question of what is gluten.
Many people are gluten-free.
Yes, and then
gluten intolerant.
Yes, and then you ask, well, what is gluten? Isn't it? Well, yeah. I mean, if you don't know what it is, how do you know that you're intolerant of it or allergic to it?
Now, lactose intolerance is a thing. Remember Damon? He was very flatulent. That's because he kept having milk and all kinds of dairy. Now, that's a thing. So if you say it's lactose intolerant,
for me, if I have full cream milk, then my stomach doesn't feel great at all. So I can, like, literally, I have fights with every coffee shop because I'm like, can I get a skinny whatever? That just means give me low fat milk. Which I basically want watered down milk because that's what low fat milk is.
Exactly.
So if I'm having something full cream, it really, and then I can feel it. And on my first sip, I'll just be like, oh, it was full cream milk. Literally, physically, you feel it. But there's nothing, unless you've actually got whatever celiac disease, whatever it's called, then gluten is a thing. But for most people, like when people say it to me, then I'm like, I'm gluten intolerant. And then I'm like, is that like, self-diagnosed or for realsies,
if it's parental diagnosed, second generation.
Yes.
I just imagined what a difficult life you are potentially living.
Yes.
So the issue for you is full cream.
Mm.
So does that mean that you can't have full cream in anything? So
no.
Ice cream.
Literally, coffee. Coffee is the thing. For my sister, it's like dairy products. Anything, be it yogurt, freaking cheese. And it's not that you're gonna fall down and die. You just don't feel on top of your game.
Yeah.
You feel sluggish. Your stomach just feels like it's a little bit kind of off. And for her, it's all sort of dairy products. So she's like relegated to Cremora or whatever. Black coffee. So whereas for me, it's purely coffee. No ice cream.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. All over.
Or maybe it's just because I love milkshake and ice cream. So I will work through this.
You're not prepared to give it up.
Biting the bullets in that. So exactly, there's not enough information about what gluten is, what gluten can be harmful. And again, it's like we brought up this whole thing about mouthwash, right? So Listerine was a company had floor cleaning products.
Mm.
And they thought, okay, well, hang on a second. Bad breath's a real killer socially. Let's create. They invented halitosis. They invented halitosis. Somebody has invented gluten-free diets. We haven't quite worked out who it is just yet.
No, but here's the thing. All of pop culture is invented, guys, and not invented by people with PhDs. Breakfast is the most important meal of the day.
It's a lie.
It was a slogan of a 1940s cereal company in the States.
Yes.
It's a way that they peddled cereal.
Exactly.
It was not a doctor who decided that.
Yeah.
No, it was the guy who wanted people to stop masturbating. That's a story for another time. You know,
because
cornflakes, as we all know, was developed so people would stop masturbating.
Let's not leave that for another day.
Let's tackle this right now.
Kellogg's cornflakes.
Yes.
It was.
I failed to see the link here.
It was this. Well, people still to this day do, but Kellogg, the dude, okay, he
Mr. Kellogg,
he thought that. Because he was very much into that you can't have sex unless you're going to reproduce. And even then, I think he was quite sketchy on that.
Yeah.
And he thought that all this immoral behavior, you do not ever pleasure yourself. Because if you were to masturbate, you would get syphilis.
Mm.
You would get all these different things. Your face would start
to
rot.
That's where it comes from.
Your face would start to rot. I've actually got a video, but it'll take me about 2 minutes to find it now. I'll pick this up.
Mm.
But so he said the cure for common masturbation is a high-carb breakfast, start of the day meal, and he made cornflakes to stop you from masturbating.
Jeez.
Wow.
So if you
I'm gonna stop because my eldest eats cornflakes. Like I try to get him onto other things. I'm like, have some future life, boy. Cornflakes, please, Dad. Cornflakes, please, Dad.
But now, so
and he's
you...
always playing with himself.
Well, there we go. So now Kellogg is rolling in his grave because he decided.
I just mean like in a like a prepubescent boy kind of way. They just cannot leave it alone.
Yeah.
It's always fiddling.
It's just part of the developmental process. Yeah. Nothing wrong with it.
So right now, Dr. Kellogg is going, oh, how could that go wrong? I had this perfect curve of masturbation. People are now masturbating after cornflakes.
Okay, well, now that we're on this tip, I wanna tell you about some of the Japanese customs and cultures, because, you know, I love the Japanese. Most of the time, you know, they've got great foresight. They're very liberated, like very, you know, very rarely are they ashamed of certain things. And so when it comes to good luck superstitions, the Japanese are right up there when it comes to, you know, the things that they believe will, you know, bring you good luck. So in ancient Roman times, for example, if you studied the insides of a pig, you know, you could use that to be a key to finding out what your future holds and to determine your luck. In Hindu tradition, rain before you get married is seen as good luck. You know, it will bless the union and all of that. In Egypt, it's not uncommon for women to pinch the bride just before she gets married. So we're focusing on superstitions specifically related to people who are getting married. Mm. But in Japan, it is quite customary for a bride to mount a giant wooden penis. And then what happens is she gets paraded down the streets in a penis festival.
It's like a Trojan penis, because obviously there's wheels on that.
Well, I mean, let's see. How long and big is this thing? It's quite a few feet long, okay?
It doesn't help the Asian stereotype either. A lot of times she's going to mount a huge penis.
It is an actual penis festival. It is held on the second Sunday of March, so it happened this past Sunday that we've just come out of. It happens every year. Women who have been married in the past year put on traditional Japanese bridal gowns. They mount the phallus, and then they are paraded down the street.
This is fantastic.
I'm going to that festival. I am going.
I mean, I just, you know, just do your thing. Do what makes you happy. Who cares what the rest of the world thinks? But I love it.
But that's kind of Japan's view on the world.
It is.
Like, listen, guys, we've got some things we do here, hey?
Yeah, but the thing is, where Japan is geographically, think about it, okay? They get... like the day first. The day starts in Japan, so they're very much in the future.
Yes.
Everything about them, geography, science, the whole deal, they're out in front. This is a country that has sex game shows. Not just game shows. But sex game shows.
And they do seem very liberal. It seems like it's just a thing.
Yeah.
They said they're not on Dr. Kellogg's path.
Sure. No, they did not, invent cornflakes.
No, not interested in the Dr. Kellogg's theory at all.
No.
Spiders, right? Sorry, Stuart, we just had so many. It's a backlog of stories here. I've got to get this out. Spiders, should we like them or should we hate them?
Well, I don't care about what we should do. I don't like spiders.
Okay. Well, do you know that spiders are actually really, really massively important for various reasons? One of them is because they eat horrible insects.
They are horrible themselves.
Yeah. Okay. But how about this for numbers, right? So world spiders eat between 400 and 800 million tons of insects every single year.
There we go.
First thing to consider, how boring is your life if you're following these spiders around? How many scientists are doing this? But that is just ridiculous. That is essentially all the humans in the world, okay, and all the meat and fish that we eat is the same as what spiders are eating insects. That is like mind blown for this day.
Yes.
So there's about 65 studies that threw out all the stuff together. And if you were to take the weight of all the spiders on Earth, 25 metric tons.
Wow.
Spiders, okay? And every single spider eats other things. That you don't get a herbivore spider. So they're just eating other living things.
What was that other video that went viral the other day of a spider that attacked or killed something that was massively larger than
itself?
It
killed a snake. A spider killed a snake in Australia.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, well, I haven't.
Have you landed at Australia's airport, though?
No.
Australia's airport, they've got this wall of fame of all of their creatures that they've got. And it's like, really, at arrivals, they're like, welcome to Australia, home to... And then it's like, but they basically boast about the fact they've got more... like reptiles and spiders and whatever than the rest of...
Well, killer reptiles and spiders.
Yes, exactly. Mm. And it's just like, and then they go, it's just a wall of things you could possibly see while you're in Sydney.
A wall of things, guys, that could also possibly kill you. Yes, I mean, Australia's animals are on another level.
They are. It's that thing of they're isolated. They've been evolving quietly in isolation.
But these spiders, okay, so there's 45,000 known species and they can travel up to 30 kilometers a day with their spider webs and stuff to go and eat other things.
That's far.
That's efficient.
That's crazy. But then on the other side of the scale, 8,000 species of birds, other predators and parasites eat spiders. Circle of life.
Hmm.
But one story that has really actually got my attention this week is the biltong scientist. Now,
yes.
Stuart, you might know a bit more about this than we do because you actually studied at University of Stellenbosch.
I did.
And you did the sciences.
I did the sciences. She's Stellenbosch as well. Yeah. She got a PhD in biltong.
Yeah.
I've tasted good biltong. And in all honesty, even bad biltong is still good biltong. It's a little bit like pizza in that.
Well, it depends how strong your teeth are. I try to tell an 80-year-old man that.
True. But, I mean, you can suck it. Use your gums and suck on that biltong, boy.
Oh.
Delish. Nothing beats biltong for snacky. It's just, it's like the perfect snacky kind of food. So how on earth did you get a PhD? Because I just went to Checkers and got that little box that you can buy for 180 Rand. Yeah. And you put in 2 penlight batteries and you hang some meat. And then turns it into biltong. I mean, you get that thing at Checkers.
Really?
And you get your spices.
You buy spice, you put on meat, you soak meat in vinegar. I mean, there's a bit of a process. It doesn't necessarily taste as good as the chili bites I buy at the biltong shop across the way.
Yeah.
But it's still pretty good biltong. So I'd need to taste this woman's biltong to see if she deserves PhD.
Again, it's a great marketing exercise for what you just studied, right?
Exactly.
Because she can go to Checkers, you know, like Nathaniel and his Boerewors.
Exactly.
Just came up yesterday as well, actually. If Nathaniel puts his name on Boerewors right now, it's like, yeah, there's going to be cool spices in there. It's going to be artisan. Like this chick, she can go straight into, let's just call it Checkers again, with her line of PhD biltong.
Yeah.
PhD biltong.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful.
Well, you see, the thing is,
pressure,
I mean, the thing is, they made it sound like it was quite a precise science with her. So, you know, she examined everything from the different processes of drying the biltong.
Yeah.
Then there's the question of the kind of bacteria that gets incorporated into the drying process. I mean, I don't know if you're, you know, thinking about the bacteria where you've got your meat hanging at home
it's rotting meat.
Yeah.
There's bound to be some bacteria make it taste better.
And people are excited about gluten-freeness.
Yeah.
Hanging meat. So what drew you to the sciences in the beginning?
Bad guidance counseling. in a short answer. I literally, my guidance counselor, this is typical pre-1994 government gutter education kind of vibes, right? So, if you're at the school, you just go and work. That's your job. And maybe like the one or two people a year will go to university. And that's got to be UWC because that's the slightly more affordable people of color university. Once a decade, one kid will maybe rise up and go to UCT. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there were three of us in our year who were kind of academically were fine. And then, I went to my dad said to me, hey, how about Stellenbosch? And I was like, where's that? I grew up in Crossy Park, like 40 minutes away. There's this town. I didn't know that. So in standard 9, grade 11, my dad drives me to Stellenbosch the Sunday afternoon. We get out. And if you've been to Stellenbosch and you arrive at the Rooi Plein, you literally will fall in love with this place. I mean, it's just the most beautiful. Yeah. And it's summer. So are just belters walking everywhere. They have short skirts. I'm like, oh, and is this, you can learn things here. So I got back to school the Monday and guidance counseling, the chick is like, listen, well, Stu, have you given any thought to it? UWC or Pentec, which is your choice. And then I said, I think I want to go to Stellenbosch. And then she said to me, where is that? So this was the guidance counselor.
Oh, right? Dear. Okay.
So I literally had to kind of figure out the path for myself. And the reason for science was a very simple. It was academic. I liked maths and I liked science. I liked biology. So I was like, well, let's just study a general science degree. And as terrible as it was, by the end of my second year when I had to specialize, I literally went, what marks did I score better in, plants or animals? Animals. Okay, cool. Zoology was my major.
But did you enjoy any of it throughout the process?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it. It's such an interesting thing. I mean, zoology and animal physiology, which is my majors, it's great. It really is. It's a third of the time you're in the lab, a third of the time you're in lectures, and a third of the time you're just out in the world. You like, you spend so much time at the beach.
Yeah.
I mean, because this is the thing, that thing of insects, you're talking about how many insects there are relative, how many insects spiders eat relative to these big things. This is the thing you realize about zoology and those subjects, is that what we see as animals is a microscopic amount of the actual living beings on this planet. So you go to a rock pool in Strand and you drop a 1 meter by 1 meter square bit of metal. Bang, you just drop it down. And if you counted all the animals and living beings in that 1 square meter, it's like really there's hundreds of things over there, yeah. Be it whatever, mollusks and all sorts of things.
Sure.
But it's like, isn't it? I saw a stat the other day. For every one human on Earth, is a million ants.
There you go.
Something like that.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, there is this world that we do not see. We assume that we are the biggest, and we've got the big five that we look at. Yeah. So but there are the others as well.
So then how did you somehow get into magic after that?
Oh, no, I got into the magic stuff before. When I was at school, I was at primary school, then I saw a magician.
I'm trying very hard to get this
figure out the chronology.
To plot the evolution.
On an academic side, that was my vibe. Yeah. At school, I liked science, and I was a bit of a maths dude, and then I went and studied that. But I did, but just to kind of wrap up the science thing, I did. By the time I was getting to the end of my degree, I realized that was not the future. I had multiple ideas for what I was going to do. Possibly. But I did. I just wanted to finish it. That was my big thing. Just sure. Started it. Just finish it.
Get a degree. It looks good.
Yes, it does look good. Paid and maybe you can do something else. Exactly. But parallel to that, while I was at primary school, I saw a dude do magic tricks at a mall. And I was like, wow, I want to do that when I grow up. Then you get your magic set and you do your magic show for your parents in the lounge. You know, those kind of vibes. I made them sit through a long magic show, the first one. It was hours.
Next trick. Yeah.
Then when I got to kind of standard six, grade eight, I said to my parents, oh, listen, I found out about this place called the College of Magic. Can we go on this like little visit to it? And it's a place in Cape Town where they teach kids how to do magic. And I mean, it's been going for 30 years now. This is the year that they're turning 30. Yeah, 30? Yeah, about 30 years old.
Have you been invited back for a big performance?
I go back all the time. They do a show called Stars of Comedy and Magic. Mm-hmm. And myself, Riyad Musa, Conrad Koch, we all kind of go and perform there. Because that's where I met Riyad Musa. I met Conrad Koch there. I met Jason Cobb. Jason, if you are a big movie buff, you'll know Jason. So we all kind of know each other since we were like 11, 12 years old.
Oh, wow. That's a lot of history there.
Yes. No. I mean, we've known each other for a lot longer than we don't know each other. And in fact, Riyad, myself and Conrad kind of got into the comedy thing at the same time, because what happened was they were at UCT and I was at Stellenbosch. Mm. And UCT's drama department, in my second last year of university, had a comedy night. They had this comedy night at Barney's and they invited some of the kids from the drama department, and they knew Conrad was a ventriloquist. They knew that Riyad was a magician. So Paul Snodgrass, Dave Levinson popped in over there. They knew Mark Lottring was this new performer coming up, so they invited him for a couple of minutes. And it became a fairly regular thing, like once every Thursday, well, every end of the month on a Thursday, people would pack into this pub called Barney's and they pay you $50 in alcohol. That's what they would pay you. So it was going for 2 or 3 months, and then eventually Riyad couldn't do it. He was studying medicine at the time, so his workload was hectic, and he called me. He said, Stu, do you want to come and do this thing? It's lots of fun. And I arrived, and I arrived in a suit because I'm a magician.
Look at you.
And then everyone is just like their performers in shorts. I'm like, this is so disrespectful. So I got up.
Was Paul Snodgrass even wearing pants?
Barely. In fact, he was the one in shorts. I got up there, and it was the most amazing experience as far as a performer goes. Because you got to understand, this is a dude who'd spent – so I spent all my weekends doing kid shows. That's how I made money when I was at Varsity. Mm-hmm. So you jump from kid show to kid show, 6-year-old birthday, 4-year-old birthday, 2-year-old birthday, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm at a bar. They are, the belters are there now watching the show. Nice. And they send you tequila on stage. Send that guy tequila. He looks way too uptight. I'm like, this never happens at a kid show.
Thankfully.
That should though. And then it was a cool experience, and they said, listen, we're going to get this going. We're going to kind of formalize this thing and create a sort of group of us. We're going to call it the Cape Comedy Collective. And that was the start of the Cape Comedy Collective. People like Kurt Skoendraad, Kagiso Lediga, Loyiso Gola, all of those guys. It became like a collective of like
25 of us for those first 2 years in Cape Town. We just literally performed 3 days a week or 4 days a week. And it was, and that was the thing that gave me this idea in my final year of varsity that maybe this could work. Because all my friends who had kind of finished varsity maybe the year before me were now working in labs, and they were doing those 8-hour shifts in labs. And then I would go and do my three gigs and have as much money. Then I was like, ah, lab is maybe not the future.
And nobody was sending them tequila.
But yeah, I mean, exactly.
Just to get back to the magic thing for a bit, what level of trickery were you operating at, though? I mean, were you, you know, pulling stuff out of hats? Were you stabbing yourself with objects? Like,
It was also, so I mean, for me, it was kind of like I had a very kind of comedy. The reason why they called me was that there's kind of a genre called comedy magic, where the emphasis is not so much on the amazing end of the trick. It's got to be amazing. It's got to be wow. But it's about the comical byplay. So it's kind of get someone up on stage and I'm going to do a pick a card trick. But that my pick a card trick is going to take 10 minutes because it's all the silliness and all the gags and all the lines I have for you. And you just have comical gags. So you riffle through a deck of cards. Typically, this is like 19, 20, 22, 24, 25-year-old boy's dream life, this thing where I was paid to perform, bunch of students over there. You're standing on stage, you're doing something, and this group of university students like, wow, that's amazing. Then you find the prettiest girl in the audience. You say, come up here. I want you to help me out. Give her a big round of applause. She looks amazing. So now you've really complimented her. You take out a deck of cards. And then you use all of these gags with sexual innuendo. So you riffling through a deck of cards. I want you to choose a card. Riffle through the pack. Say stop. But you do it too fast. And she's like, oh, she's like, oh, don't worry. I like girls who have trouble saying stop. Bang. And then basically if she giggles, you're like, ha.
You're like, yeah.
And by, like, I wouldn't even lie. And I can say this because it's many years ago. Like, I worked at Rutunga Junction one December.
Oh, yeah.
As a walk-around magician, right?
Okay.
And it was hard work. I made enough money to buy a car at the end of that December. But I was working, bro. Like, seriously. And I was also doing magic. Because I would do these card tricks. I'd literally just find single girls everywhere, do the card trick, and I'd always say, sign the deck. So it's like I spent lots of money on cards. Choose a card, sign the card so we know it's your card. But first I've got to do like a trick for you and I'll charm you. Then the girl's like, okay, cool, gotcha. Choose the card, sign. Then I say, write your name on the card. And as she's writing it and she's about to end, I say, and your phone number underneath. And most girls, I swear, would be like, okay.
So you did a bit of hypnosis as well, though?
Yeah, bro.
Yeah.
Well, it was good time.
I mean, at that stage, you'd already disarmed them. So yes, they'd be like,
exactly.
Sure, you can have my number.
Exactly.
Did any of this lead to relationships?
Not necessarily relationships.
This isn't how you met the love of your life or anything like that.
No. That's a rather bizarre story. that was just a party at varsity. I was literally at a party. There was a party in my room. A party happened to me. I had a new, it was like my third year of varsity, and I still had a roommate. I was at Rez, and it was, they were doing a renovation on part of the Rez. And so for the first 4 months, there was a lot of guys who had to still share the double rooms until this second section becomes available. So there was a new dude, and I'd known him. I mean, I was kind of, we knew each other, but we didn't know each other. And then he just threw this party. I got there, and then there was this party that happened.
And you just went with it.
Yeah.
But this often happens when we interview comedians or actors or musicians and stuff. You know, you start out life with one idea. It becomes very different. Did you ever get like sort of a parental pressures or pressures from your friends? Like, you know, you should really use your degree.
My parental pressure will like make you give a standing ovation to my parentals.
Okay.
So here's the full story. The part of the story I never include in these interviews because there's never time. Here's how it comes down.
We've got 3 minutes. We've got lots to do. Carry on.
Okay. Here's what it comes down to, right? Ultimately, in my final year of university, I decide that, listen, this lab work is not for me. But I don't know necessarily that the comedy thing has got legs, in all honesty.
Yeah.
So I go, what's the next best thing? So I find out about this thing called the accounting conversion course. It's a course at UCT, 1 year. It's a one-year degree. You've got to have a degree to do it. But you do BCom 1, 2, and 3, your first, second, and third year in 1 year. You start on the 4th of January. You graduate at the end of December. You go to every single class. You start class at about 7 in the morning. You end at about 7:30 at night.
Oh.
Wow.
6 days a week. On a Sunday, you do tutorials from 8 o'clock till 1 o'clock. It is grueling. But they take a very select few people, and you must have a degree because you've got to understand the pressures of what it takes to do what you did in your 3, 4, or 5 years in 1 year. Do you understand that? Cool, I understand that. The aptitude test, whatever. So I do the thing. And at this stage, I'd been earning enough money to kind of do my own kind of stuff. And I applied. And I kind of fancied a girl at UCT, and her dad was an accounting lecturer. So I think maybe he kind of snuck my application in and got me approved, because I don't know that I was necessarily the right thing.
They say it's all about who you know. It's
exactly.
True.
So I think maybe Professor Rode kind of hoed me a yes over there. But anyway, I applied for the thing, got accepted, ready to go. January, like the 2nd or the 3rd, I was sitting on my bed at my parents' house, like literally. And because I didn't have to worry about fees, like I'd only paid the registration fees, but I was going to be covered because I was going to get a ton of, like the bursaries were being thrown at us because all the big accounting firms, like, wow, let me get this straight. You've got a degree in zoology and accounting. That makes you a very niche, your knowledge very niche.
Mm.
You've got an engineering degree and an accountant. It makes your knowledge of that engineering field very valuable to us. So those accounting firms really throw money at those kids. So anyway, we're ready to do this. It's January. I'm on my bed. I'm heading to UCT. And my mom comes in. And she says, do you really want to be stuck in an office your whole life?
Oh, okay.
I never went.
You never went.
I didn't go. I went back to bed. It's like, let's tell jokes instead.
Wow.
So the pressure was on the other side. It was just an idea of, we're very happy that you think that this might be. Because all it was a safety net. It was the idea of, and they understood that, I mean, from a magic side, that was what I loved doing. And I was just going to do this to kind of almost appease them possibly and go, listen, look, I do have a degree that I'm using. Because I just went, I'm not going to use the science degree. There's no, like, I know one dude who's still in like he works at the tequila factory in Graaf-Reinet. That's like the one dude who's still in
so
the sciences.
See, he went to the tequilas.
Yes, exactly. That's how he got his tequila.
So that was it. And then from there, haven't looked back.
The story goes on, eh? I literally still decided, because it's that thing, it's a leap of faith. A leap of faith takes a long time. I stood on that edge for a long time. So I said, okay, fair enough, Mom. I'm going to do comedy for this year. It's a gap year. It's my gap year, and I'm going to figure it out. You know what? Then I got wind of the fact that you can do a MPhil, a master's, in animal physiology.
Okay.
Okay.
That's what I love. I love animal physiology.
Yeah.
It's a 2-year structured course. You go three months of classes, 3 months off, 3 months of classes, 3 months off, for 2 years. At the end, you get a master's degree. So I'm going, oh, that's a cool idea. I can spend still 3 months of performing, 3 months of, because you're supposed to go and work to earn money. I'll do those comedy stuff. And then you come, that's cool. And then I'll have a master's at the end of it. But it's at Stellenbosch University. Like, literally, I'd probably be the first person of color with a master's degree in that zoology and animal physiology department. That means instant post as a junior lecturer, which means by the time I'm like 27, I've started my PhD. By the time I'm 30, I've got a PhD, first person of color PhD from Stellenbosch, which means that by the time I'm 35, I'm the head of the department. By the time I'm 40, I'm the dean of the faculty. By the time I'm 50, I get to be the rector of the university. This is an awesome path. And as a lecturer, I kind of, it's like a gig every day because you're performing every day. Fork those kids. You're doing gags about animals.
So I mean,
this is cool.
So at that time, you weren't really looking at the comedy, as the full-time thing that
I didn't know that it had the potential.
Yeah.
So I kind of spent 6 months on my gap year thinking, I'm going to go back. I'm going to go and do this master's next year. I've taken the year off. I already am not registered. And in August, I went back to university and I said, listen, I want to register for this master's. And they said, well, it runs every second year.
Mm.
And it has already started this year, which means you can't start next year. You're going to have to wait another year.
And at that stage, I was getting a lot of pressure from the comics saying to me, Stu, you need to move out of your the kind of bachelor pad at your parents' house, and you've got to do this thing full time. If you want to make a career of it, you're just mucking around, yeah.
Was it a frightening thought at the time when, you know, when they're putting that kind of pressure on you?
It was, because life was great at home. I mean, I was it was a separate entrance. I just walked to my parents' house and get some cool drink if I want, but they never came to my place. It was like, it was great. Nice. And then I was like, okay, cool. Is this the universe telling me, Stu, it's time to take a plunge? And then I did. I moved in with Kurt Skundrat because his housemate happened to be moving back to France. And I was spending most of my time there by him and her anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So it's been I was going through your bio prior to the show because, I mean, there is a whole bunch about you. I mean, if people don't know too much about your comedy, there's that show, the travel show.
Yeah, Going Nowhere Slowly.
The Going Nowhere Slowly thing. I mean, that obviously was a byproduct of a comedy, but 17 years of stand-up.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while.
Do you ever hear that now and go, shit, where's the time going?
I do. Here's the thing. I got asked to like host the thing with a whole bunch of what I consider like old comics. They're like, would you host it? And I was like, what? Why would I possibly host it?
Exactly. You are established comic.
I'm an established. No, I just turned 40. I turned 40 like 2 weeks ago.
Oh.
I'm having this. And then that call came like 2 days after my 40th birthday. I had a beard for a year, which I now have shaved off, so I hope
but I mean, were you feeling a particular type of way about turning 40? Because apparently, it happens to most people is they get there and they think, "Oh shit, I'm 40."
I think I'm still in that phase. I mean, we only had the party on Saturday, so I'm still recovering from that. That's what I have realized is that you cannot party like you are having your 30th birthday. Like it was a lot of the people. That was cool. It was a lot of people at my 30th birthday. Was at my 40th birthday. So that speaks to like friendships holding. Sure. Test of time, not like me, like 20 people, but a lot more people passed out at my house at my 40th birthday than my 50th birthday.
Yeah.
People were slinking home at 5 in the morning. Just I kept on knocking on the door. Can you open the gate? I've got to leave, please. So I was like, yeah, like okay, at 40, you clearly cannot hold your choice of whatever, your choice of poison.
That's true. You've also become quite well known for your one-man shows. I mean, that's got to take the biggest amount of balls in comedy. Like, it's one thing being a part of a bill.
Yes.
Comedy nights. But, and like, with you, I know you've been doing some things with Bright Rock recently, which is very much like a true life kind of thing.
Yes.
So you're putting yourself out there. I mean, like, did you get to a point where you thought that was just your next step to become bigger, or did you always think of yourself as like a good one man show?
You know what? I've had the privilege of working with some really cool directors in my earlier days. And I think if you look at my early material, I just spoke about the world out there. I speak about flowers or about water or whatever. And then I worked with spiders. I worked with a dude named Heinrich Reisenhoff, an amazing theater director. And he was like, just what's the stories inside, dude? What's your story? Just tell your story. And he always kind of pushed that agenda that people are going to find your stories interesting. And then that kind of became how I started writing. And if you're writing one-man shows, which are thematic, you have to look within. I mean, firstly, it's very difficult to look outside, because that's where a lot of negativity is. Like, if you start searching the world for material, it's a negative place. Whereas if you go within, you'll find some, you'll just go, how do I feel about this place? What's my, as Joey Razdin would say, what's my point of reference? What's my thing?
So, like, for new young comedians coming up, you'd say that'd be the best thing to start with. It's the whole introspective, your stories.
Because
your
it's going to be unique, man. Yeah. And you know what? It's the details that people, like, you think that minute detail is unique to you. It's the minute details which we all have in common.
Exactly, because everyone does have a little nuance. I mean, look at this show. We've all got our own opinions about the most trivial of things.
Yeah.
And it does flow quite nicely.
Exactly.
Now, one of the shows that obviously was very well known was Lone Husband. Was this pretty much completely your life experiences translated?
It was the wife. Shame. People always start shaming your wife. And then I'm like, well, the wife, and even in, because we wrote a book, the wife character, if you want to call her that, is kind of a collection of many wives that I know. So some of them, quite a few of them are not necessarily my wife's stories. It's sort of friends of my wife or my friends' wives. Mm. So like, well, we have many couple friends, and kind of Daniel tells me a story and Rody tells me a story, and those kind of nuances of the wife becomes my stage wife. So she understands that it's not necessarily her I'm talking about, but she knows when it's her I'm talking about. She knows.
And was she all for it? Like in the beginning, was she a bit apprehensive?
She'd never seen it because myself and Heinrich actually worked on that show and we wrote it in isolation. We went away for many weeks and we came back and we wrote the show over December. I didn't get to have much of a Christmas New Year because we were opening a show around about the 12th of January in a very big venue at the Baxter. So there was pressure of producing the show, but the pressure of creating the show. And I knew it was going to be something special, and we worked on it. And at one point, I was in the kitchen, I was on my laptop, and I'd left some of the script open, and she started reading it. And then when I got back in, she was here, she's like with this perplexed look on her face, staring at my laptop. What shit is this? What shit is this? And I was like, just, you don't read it, you have to watch it.
Yeah.
And so she was very apprehensive about the show because she didn't know what it was about. It was kind of like a bold leap forward because it was almost anti-stand-up. Heinrich didn't want it to feel like a stand-up show. He wanted it to feel a bit like an experience. He wanted it to feel like he wanted to be absolute theater. He wanted to make it feel like it was one of those Tony Robbins experiences.
Like a life for tutorial
husbands.
Almost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it was like a motivational thing for husbands. Like wives who had brought their husbands to this thing. Come on, honey, you need some training. And it was like husband training. And it was like I walked out there with a headset mic and motivational vibes. Da-da-da-da, do a bit of preachy bit and get all the guys to stand up. If you're a confused husband, stand up right now. And we get all the guys to do this oath in the beginning. It was like really cool. And literally, as much as it was written by Heinrich Hadoud, who wasn't married at that point, and myself, who was a very confused husband, we knew without a shadow of a doubt that the people in Cape Town who buy tickets are women.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Theater tickets are bought by women. Women decide they want to buy.
Same the holidays. There's stats around that.
Yeah. And so even with a poster, what the poster needs to look like, we'd show women and we ask their opinion. What do you think of these two posters? One way I'm looking a lot more arrogant. And they always chose the one way I was a bit more downtrodden. Yeah. But so we knew that the narrative had to be women had to walk out of their game. That was such a cool show. But guys had to, we mustn't out guys on their thing.
Mm.
Yeah, on sure. Whatever bullshit we do. So yeah, and it was cool. And when she saw the show, she was like, ah, no, that was cool. That was fun.
Now, on a global scale, we're always comparing each other's senses of humor. And, you know, we make jokes out of that. So, for example, we'll say, oh, well, you know, Germans, Russians, not really that much of a sense of humor compared to, you know, other nationalities. And you've obviously performed on the international circuit. Mm. You've performed to different audiences. Is that whole sense of humor thing really true? So when you're performing in Switzerland or in Canada or in, you know, wherever it is that you've performed, do you always have to take that into cognizance, the fact that, well, I might have to adjust a little bit to this audience because...
I think it's often just their point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for me, the question becomes, what do they need to know to find this funny? So I was doing a gig in Switzerland, and it's like all these people, and I've got this funny gag about homeless people. I mean, it's a jibe at people who treat homeless people as though they are invisible. So it's a gag about the area I live in, it's the kind of area where people step over a homeless person to help a lost dog, that kind of area. And I say to the homeless, dude, you must try barking. Like maybe, you know, don't, try woof woof. Maybe you'll get a meal.
Yeah.
So I got these gags about privilege. It's about observed privilege in a neighborhood in the neighborhood I live in. And so you do that in Switzerland, then they just like, but we do not get it. Because,
yeah, that does not apply to us here.
Like they wouldn't ever step over another human being. So it's often you go, what is it that they need to know in order to make this funny.
Wow, that's pretty interesting.
As opposed to because funny is funny. Like things are just funny, but you have to know certain things in order to make it funny.
Mm.
Yeah.
So obviously the whole one man thing, and you know, you can hold your own, but there must have been influences through this whole procedure which made you get better. I mean, like internationally, there's guys are getting a huge amount of profile. We can't help but notice them. So who were some of the big influences?
You know what? I got to thank Heinrich for this. Initially, I think, and every comic, as soon as you can see a comic who's been watching Eddie Izzard DVDs, because suddenly there's very many Eddie Izzard influences. Or when you turn on your first Chris Rock DVD, you just have to go and buy that leather jacket. You know what I mean? It's like, and so we all went through that phase. I mean, Chris Rock, Eddie Izzard, those were probably the two big ones for me in terms of style. And again, I've got to credit Heinrich for this. We were working on our first show together. It was called Technicolored. And I did some nuance. And he said, why do you do that? And I said, it's because it's a thing I say. He said, I've heard so many comics, local comics say it. And then I said, we all say it. He's like, but why do you, and I think his line was, why do you all dip into the same pool of mediocrity?
Mm.
I was like, yeah, bro, that's like the most hard, you cut me deep. How can you say that?
Mm.
And he's like, no, just, I mean, find your own voice. Okay, from here on out, you want to work with me? You're not allowed to watch any other comics again. And I literally, he meant for while we were writing the show. And about three shows later, he'd asked me, had I seen whatever, Louis C.K.? I was like, no, you know, tell me I can't watch comics. Then he said, when did I say that? That's when we were working on Technicolor. You said, I can't watch. He's like, yeah, for that show to help you find your voice. I just meant for the months we're working on it, don't watch anyone else. Just be on stage, be you, find your funny, and then you'll have your voice. So, yeah.
Did you also find, like, I always wonder this, you look at a comedy show and you look at the people who are performing, do you find that sometimes with the right comedians, you'll have a better performance if you're all on one bill at the same time?
You know what, for me, where promoters get it right is in terms of flow, in terms of understanding what styles fit together. It's the understanding of how to put together a show. Which some promoters get wrong.
Yeah.
And some promoters stumble upon it by accident. And some promoters are smart enough to get a very good MC and then listen to the MC. And the MC says, take this act, put it here, move that act over there. And it's because that person knows how to MC and they've been doing it for a while and they understand the acts.
Mm.
So for us, for example, this show which we produce in the Big Five Comedy Show, that one, we literally, I mean, we had a kind of idea of, listen, these are the sort of comics we want to work with. But we also were well aware of finding balance within our lineups. So you go, you want something that appeals to everyone, so that's not exactly the same narrative throughout the show. In fact, if you can get two completely opposing narratives in one show, that's a thing of beauty. When you see an audience applauding for something, and the next comic comes and turns that entire idea on its head, and you just see that audience go, ooh, okay, that's an interesting way of looking. Actually, I applaud for that too. That's cool. That's great to have that. And we try to create that sort of balance with the shows that we do.
It is so important. I mean, okay, so the current show now, you've already performed this whole Big Five comedy show in Cape Town,
yes,
right? So
yes.
It's coming up now in Joburg, what, Easter weekend?
Easter weekend. So literally we are a month away. Today will be the final show.
So it's Joburg. You and who else?
So we've got Barry Hilton as the headliner.
Okay.
As kind of old guard. We've got Jason Goliath as the newest addition. We've got Joey Razdin and we've got Kagiso Lediga as well.
And of course yourself.
And myself. I get to host it, so it's lots of fun.
Yeah. That is so cool. And and again, like you said, like the history of many of you guys coming from the Cape.
Yes, yes.
And it must be cool.
Our first one we did last year. And as I said, there's like we have a wish list of like 10 acts we want to use for this brand over the next couple of years. We feel fit the bill of the Big Five. And it will change because we want to shake it up and we want to give other guys opportunities. And certainly someone like Jason, where you go, what an amazing year you've had.
Yeah.
It's almost like a reward system. Dude, work as hard as this guy, get your show on television, and you get to join this.
You guys
this
are like comedy Avengers.
Absolutely. Yeah. I like that. I
can just see the poster now. It looks fantastic.
Just so good in spandex. I think Barry's going to work well.
Barry in spandex is going to be a different kind of comedy.
So you guys had a good run in Cape Town, now coming
Cape
to Johannesburg.
Cool. Yes, yes, yes.
Any plans to take it to other parts
of
the country?
It's the absolute idea of the Big Five. So I realized in terms of performing abroad that there's a massive appetite for South African comedy abroad, but it's very difficult to do it on your own. So I thought, well, why don't we create a property? If you go to a whatever festival, Melbourne Comedy Festival, Montreal, there'll be like, you're in Montreal, but and they have these themed shows, a love show or whatever show, and it's about relationships. But then they'll have the Best of Down Under or the Best of British.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, why is there no Best of African or Best of South African?
Sure.
Because we have many, many to showcase. So I wanted to create a brand that could live possibly at those festivals or independently of those festivals. And the idea was, well, what's a very positive South African image? The Big Five. The Big Five.
Exactly,
everyone knows it. So the idea is to take the Big Five outside of SA and showcase South African comedy. But for now, it's also about building the brand locally so that we can kind of have the stats of going, listen, I mean, it's a big brand. It's powerful. We can fill up theaters or stadiums or whatever the heck we want to do with the brand. So we started in Cape Town last year as a pilot project. This year, we're rolling it out as a national tour. So we just finished the Grand Arena in Cape Town. We are at Monte Cassino at the Teatro over Easter weekend, which is in a month's time. Then we head off to PE at the ICC in June, I believe 10th of June. Those bookings will open at the end of this month.
So you got some momentum then to go to PE.
Yes, yes. We had to work on it. A running start for PE. Well, I don't know. We'll have a lot of momentum because Durban is only in August. Yeah, so that's kind of the rollout for the year. And then, but our big one obviously being Joburg. Joburg in a month's time.
And then as far as one-man show futureness, is there anything else in the pipelines you're thinking of?
Well, I'm going down to Grahamstown this year with a work in progress, and that's literally what it is. I don't even know what it's called, the show. But it's going to be me trying to find out what it is I want to say in my next one-man show. It's going to be a very interesting thing. It's just at stage time every day. I love Grahamstown for that. If people come, they come. If they don't, they don't. You've got a venue, a mic, and hopefully a couple of people you can bounce some ideas off. That's what Grahamstown is going to be for me. And I've got theatre dates, which is being booked for sometime next year. We're trying to juggle one-man show in one half of the year and Big Five 2018 in another half. So after this theatre run, we'll kind of figure out where Big Five lives, and then I'll slot in with my show on the outside.
I mean, I didn't realize that the Big Five brand or project is such, you know, you've thought about it in such a long-term way, because yeah. It sounds like it's potentially... could grow into this beautiful monster.
We really want it to be kind of a legacy project. That's, right. That's what I want to do.
This is a guy that was getting tequilas for magic shows. he's always going to think the next level.
This is true. So going forward, will it always be the same Big Five, or will you switch it up, bring in new guys?
I guarantee that next year will not be the same. Yeah. It's going to have to evolve. Mm. I've hosted this tour. Maybe I'd like to just do a slot in the next tour and then not do the third time at tours and be focusing possibly on taking some of those guys overseas. While I think it's almost like a blue man group. It's got the potential to be running in multiple places at the same time.
Yeah.
If you had a kind of touring group, so it's or like a Cirque du Soleil, you kind of go, well,
yeah, exactly.
we hone it in SA on a tour in 2017, and those guys get to do the world in 2018 while a different group does 2017.
That would be exciting, because then you could also, you know, bring in some of the, you know, like some of the guys from Nigeria or comics out of...
Absolutely. I really would like it to kind of be a pan-African thing, yes. Ultimately. I think it's... And we've got so many great South... or at least African artists, comics. I mean, there's the Joburg International Festival happening at the end of this month with a whole bunch of guys coming from all over Africa. Really, really talented. And I get to... The worst thing is I play with these guys in Switzerland or in Germany as opposed to playing with them in South Africa. I'm like, why didn't you guys? But the problem is South Africa really does feel like it's so far removed from the rest of the world.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what Luis Golau, he's just moved to London now. The idea that if you're in London, New York is 6 hours away, man.
Yeah.
So he was literally, he did the Big Five with us in Cape Town, and the next day he got on a flight, and he was like, and his plans literally was, I'm going to be in London for a week before I go to Australia for 2 months. And then on the Tuesday tweeted, just got to head off to the Apollo to host Africa Night at the Apollo. It's like, because you can do that.
Nice.
In South Africa, you'd have to go, I need 3 days of travel and I need a sleeping bag. No, if you're in London, you can go. So, yes, I think it's going to be a pan-African thing eventually.
Well, I'm excited. So tickets are available from CompuTicket.
That's exactly where you get your tickets.
Yep, so it'll be April 14, 15, 16, looking at here.
Mm, yes, who's in? Is Joburg a full place during Easter? Do people stick around?
Oh. Well,
if you could go by Justice's Finances Outlook, people don't go away as much as they used to. They will be going to comedy shows. This is what Pravin Gordhan said. Comedy shows during Easter.
Okay, there we go. Comedy shows during Easter. There's one place you've got to go, and that's at the Teatro. Amazing lineup. And what I love is the diverse group that we've managed to get together for Joburg. It's going to be so much fun.
Cool. So it's been great getting to know you a little bit better.
Thank you very much, man.
Very interesting. Very fun.
Yes,
That's pretty much all the time we have for today. Perhaps the show has run just so quickly.
That's
tomorrow,
okay. That's fine.
Tomorrow is Friday. Still no Gareth. Gareth will be back next Monday officially, and he'll be able to tell you all about South by Southwest. The way I see it is we're going to start the show on Monday. Mubs and I are going to sit here, and we're literally actually going to fall asleep because Gareth's just going to talk himself hoarse for like 3-4 days, and then eventually he's going to go, so Mubs, what do you think? So at which point you'll go, yeah, Gareth, I think it's really great. I think it's so cool, and your pictures were great too. And he'll go, Thanks.
You know, when he's missed an entire week of just talking on air, he's going to find a way to make up for it. So you're probably right.
Yeah, so you know what? I think tomorrow, if we've got any stories, things we want to get out, we're going to get them out tomorrow.
Get them out tomorrow, guys.
Alan Ford with the Unview is up next. Alan Ford's always interesting, and he always has incredible guests. And he often makes really inappropriate sexual advances on those guests, because it's live radio, they try to laugh it off, but you can just see it scars them for like quite a long time. I'm just talking about last week. I mean, I didn't even know what happened the week before that.
Sure.
Alan, are you coming here to defend yourself? Hands off Stuart.
I know Alan. I know Alan very well.
Ah, Stuart,
he doesn't just make sexual advances in the studio.
We do.
When you are at professional corporate meetings at Brainstorm.
We hold hands and we sit together. Hey, Stu, don't
I'm good. Well, yes, yes.
You look beautiful, doll.
Thank you very much.
We actually spent some time in Cape Town this week.
Yeah, we did.
It was very romantic.
Alan, I find far too many of your stories start with we spent some time in Cape Town this week.
Ben, you're full of, he's full of cucker.
He is
so full of nonsense. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm good, man. Good to see you in a different city.
Good to see you.
Take it outside.
We've got a great show lined up. Ilse Klink is coming into studio.
Ilse Klink,
top South African actress, and we've got a few wonderful other things happening. But yeah, it's going to be good stuff. Africa Milani's on the show as well. Quite a Cape vibe happening here.
Indeed.
This is Cape Town in Johannesburg.
Stuart, at some stage, you'll be pulled onto the show.
I hope so. Stuart's like my brother. You may.
Yeah.
Great.
All right. If you
that's the Unview happening.
All right, cool. That's it. All time we've got today. If you missed all the stuff on live, catch the podcast, cliffcentral.com, all of those very good things from me, Ben Karpinski, and Mabali Maloy. We are out of here, and we're now going to play out with Drake, because I've had enough of Ed Sheeran.
Thank goodness.
He was still there. Did you hear that?
Oh, man. Not again. Yeah, I learned a game from William Wesley.
Cliffcentral.com.